This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. The 2020 election is certainly one for the history books. It was shaped by a global pandemic, a volatile economy, a nationwide racial justice movement, and a record number of people casting ballots. Younger Americans turned out in very big numbers. An ongoing Tufts University study shows, as of November 9th, at least 50% of eligible voters between the ages of 18 and 29 cast a ballot this year. To find out how young voters shape elections and politics, we've asked Professor Kalila Brown-Dean to share with us her insights. She's an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut, and she joins us via Skype. Professor Brown-Dean, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Is it at all possible to tell if younger voters in that 18 to 29 block were motivated more by local or national issues in this election?
Well, I think this election was unique because young people saw those two as being inextricably linked. Mm. They were motivated by the pandemic. They were motivated by the racial reckonings and uprisings we saw across the U.S. this summer. But I think they also saw how it impacts their everyday lives, from whether they can go to school and be with their friends or whether they feel safe in their homes.
So, for example, if we take the killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis, that motivated many young people to protest and agitate for racial justice. That movement then translated to more younger people casting ballots one way or the other?
Yes, and what I think is so important to think about how young people this year became active in politics is that they were able to say, look, this isn't a concern just for people in Minneapolis, and we can do both. We can protest and we can vote. And I think young people said it's about accountability. The movement for Black Lives is now on track to be one of the largest political movements in American history. And just as young people were central to shaping the civil rights movement, they are central to shaping this movement. And to see young people come together across racial identity, across gender lines, to say they want something better for their country and their community is what is making all of us pay attention in ways we can't ignore.
Is it wrong, as is the case with other groups, I've been told directly, to consider young people as a monolith, as a solid voting block that, always vote one way or the other as a group?
Not at all. I think young people have affirmed for all of us that there is tremendous diversity that exists within groups. So even to use the phrase young people, you know, are we talking 18 to 25? Are we talking those who would not be eligible to vote, but still want to have a voice in the process? And I think what's also important is when we think about the ideological differences across young people. So just as some people were motivated to vote because they wanted to protest what they saw in Minneapolis and cities across Connecticut, there were others who said, they don't represent me. They don't speak for me. And I want to be clear that all young people don't have a particular set of views. And what I think we have to do as a country is to lift that up, to affirm that voice, and to ensure that we create spaces of civic engagement that allow all those views to flourish rather than painting young people in one way.
And do you think that's true across the country, in urban and rural areas, various states, various, you know, parts of the United States, the Northwest, the Northeast, Southeast, mm-hmm. Southwest? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think that young people are facing the same challenges, you know, whether they are in Texas or they are in Fairfield County. But the opportunities and the resources that they have to navigate those challenges definitely vary. It's interesting to me to think that young people said, look, you can't ignore us. You can't assume that we have to wait to be leaders or that we have to wait to have something to say. They've been speaking out on issues like climate, like housing insecurity, like racial justice, like gun violence. And they are saying it in a way that also challenges each and every one of us to not be complacent in our political motivations.
As I was standing in line waiting to vote on Election Day, I didn't use a an absentee ballot in advance. I went to the polls that day, and I did notice there were people, as is allowed by law, at an appropriate distance, sort of campaigning last minute for candidates on both sides of the aisle, and that included young people, both advocating for the Democrats and for the Republicans.
Right.
My question really is, what kind of group do you think in that, if again we can call them young people, in that young group did vote for the Republican side of things?
You know, I think what is unique in a state like Connecticut is that the overwhelming majority of young people in this state actually identify as independent. They don't feel that either political party really represents them or captures the diversity of their views. So many of them find that they are fiscally conservative and yet perhaps more socially liberal. And it also speaks then to those structural challenges. So you would have young people say, I'm libertarian and I'm voting for Donald Trump because his approach to government most aligns with mine. We've seen that sort of growing adherence to libertarian beliefs amongst young people. And yet you also had people who said, you know, I'm more progressive or more left of center than the candidates at the top of the Democratic ticket, but the Biden-Harris ticket may be closer to my views. And I think it then raises the question of structurally, if our laws within a state do not allow independents to vote in a primary, and that's so key because that's really when the candidates are chosen and the direction of the party and the platform, then young people then are forcing us in this year and other years to think about those structural challenges to them being more involved.
I'm talking with Professor Kalila Brown, Dean of Quinnipiac University. This isn't the first time, really, although this, as you mentioned, this is, I guess, a unique situation, this election, if not very unusual. It's not the first time that many young voters became engaged in an election and politics, and through that engagement had quite an impact on the country. 100 years ago, many young women protested for the right to vote.
Right.
Of course, the civil rights movements 50 years ago, ongoing. There was Vietnam. There's gun safety. Do these compare with this year's election?
You know, young people have been at the forefront of every major movement in the United States. And that is often because young people bring an energy. They bring a willingness to innovate. And what makes this year so unique is that young people have mastered technology that, in a way that I never could imagine or that I could ever accomplish. And that's important because it's given them platforms to have discussions. In this time when we're all physically distanced, young people are remaining socially connected and socially engaged. That's what makes this year different. And one that I think even after this election and even after we get through this pandemic, young people will be connected in a way that they can prepare us for the next one and figure out what are the priorities that they have collectively. They inherit in the future the votes that we make today. And I think young people are saying they are not willing to wait another 2 years or another 4 years to have a voice.
So then you think that the enthusiasm, the engagements that we've seen this year with this, again, I'll call it the 18 to 29 group, will last beyond this moment in time. In other words, it's not a snapshot, which perhaps we can describe other moments in history when young people have come out in droves. This one, you think, will sustain?
You know, I think we always see ebbs and flows in political interest and civic engagement, regardless of our age demographic. There's so many things that we have to navigate in our everyday lives. But what I am hearing from the young people that I work with every day, that I have the privilege of learning from every day, is that they are not willing to be silent any longer. They are not willing to accept the status quo. They are understanding that they don't have the luxury of being insulated from the realities of politics and of the realities of public policy. And so the consequences of these dual pandemics of COVID-19 and racial reckonings will be with us for a very long time. And I believe that young people understand the impact it is having on their lives today. And they are fed up with others making decisions for them.
You have that unusual position of being able to be in contact with young people on a day-to-day mm-hmm. basis. I'm wondering, did you hear any discussion among them about what they tried to do to convince others to get involved in the political process? Because as even though there were many who did get directly involved, either right. in campaigning or voting, many others did sit on the sidelines. Did you sense any enthusiasm toward the students that you have in your classes trying mm-hmm. to change that?
You know, I teach classes that challenge students to think beyond their personal experience. And the level of engagement that we have seen this semester has been amazing. You know, to have students on our campus to organize a civic engagement initiative called QU Votes. It was a nonpartisan effort. So to have students who are leaders in the Republican student organization, the Democratic student organization, come together and say, we may have different paths, but we all want the same thing. And to affirm that they as young people are best suited to speak with their peers, to encourage their peers, but to also listen. So that they were willing to understand and listen to people who said, I don't feel like my vote matters. And rather than casting those students aside, rather than trying to shame them into voting, young people were willing to listen to the why and figure out together how they could address the what of what could and should be done to bring them together. And in that way, I think young people have set a model for all of us that we have to engage these issues beyond elections, but we also have to address both the ambivalence and the rejection that many people feel within this current fractured political moment.
Have you sensed a willingness among your students to bridge the severe political divide that we see today just about everywhere?
I think there's more common ground, but there's also more of a willingness to engage because many of us have, you know, sort of self-isolated in ways that we live in these echo chambers. And so the students, you know, they're living with people who have different political views. They are in classes with people who come from different backgrounds and different experiences. So they don't have that same luxury that some other people do to not engage difference. They have to engage that difference. And the ways in which they do it, you know, in my class, we talk about building a community of respect that says we're all here to learn, we are all here to teach, and that we can disagree without being dismissive. And I think to hear from young people, you know, the pain that they are experiencing in this pandemic, the uncertainty that they are feeling is nonpartisan. And so they're able to see that and address that in their everyday lives. And I really wish more of us as adults would follow that lead.
Professor, thank you so much for your time and your insights today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor Kalila Brown-Dean is an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. We're talking about the important role that the youth vote played in the 2020 election. So joining me now is a young voter. Her name is Jenny Dodari, a student at SUNY Stony Brook on Long Island, and also an advocate for the New York City Fair Trade Coalition. And she joins us now via Skype. Hello, and welcome to The Full Story.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, certainly. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Have you voted before, or was this the first time?
Yes, I have voted before.
And for this specific election, what made it important for you to cast a ballot?
Yeah, that's an incredible question. So I think it's really important to acknowledge that it wasn't just one thing, right? We're at a really critical point in our history right now where our inability to combat climate change and rising inequality has already left so many Americans in a vulnerable place. And with globalization and automation further threatening the job security of so many Americans, there is a pressing need to transform our economy to meet the demands of this evolving world. And We need a candidate who recognizes this or is at the very least willing to work with progressive policymakers to mitigate the impact of some of these crises, many of which Americans are already facing. And I think that's what really motivated me to go to the polls.
We tend to, in the media, we tend to create groups and almost assume that, they're a monolith, which is rarely true of any large group, the youth vote included. I'm wondering, did many of your friends and peers participate in the vote too, in the election?
Yeah, I mean, I surround myself with individuals who are very social impact oriented, and they think that voting is the bare minimum that the young generation can do to participate in our democracy. So, as far as my immediate circle is concerned, we all went out and voted, and we tried to motivate as many people to vote as we could.
Does that circle include university students, since you are a student at SUNY Stony Brook?
Yes, of course, of course. It definitely does.
Did you at all, or any of your peers, the folks with whom you surround yourself, did you try to reach beyond that group, in your age group, to encourage more voting?
Yes, of course. And the reason is because there is a tendency to politicize so many issues that ought not be politicized, and climate change and inequality are some of the most important examples of these. There is a tendency to kind of say the left wants this, and because the left wants this, it's inherently bad. Or the right wants this, and because the right wants this, it's inherently bad. But there are specific policies being proposed by a variety of scholars and academics and economists that really have almost suggested to really work for all Americans. And, at the end of the day, we can play partisan politics all that we want, but there are progressive ideas being put on the center stage that really have like shown that they can be effective in the long run. So
Well, clearly you've put a lot of time and effort into learning about many of these issues, and I'm guessing talking about it with your circle of friends and peers who also went to the polls. Let's talk something more about that. Let's talk more about that in terms of the candidates that you felt best represented your desires, your important issues.
right. So I think I'm going to start by perhaps describing our current president. So you laugh, but let's talk about everything that he's doing and how dangerous some of those things are. So one of the things that he's doing is he's undermining the credibility of the free press while at the same time using misinformation to advance blatantly false ideas. We're seeing this even today with his refusal to accept Joe Biden as the new president-elect, and that's eroding the foundations of our democracy on which this country was literally founded. And at the same time, throughout the course of his presidency, he has empowered racism and used xenophobic rhetoric. He has undermined the gravity of both climate change and COVID-19. We saw initially in March that COVID-19 was referred to as a hoax. And we have seen through his nomination of Judge Barrett that he is willing to put figures in really important positions of power that recognize scientifically concluded realities, such as climate change, as quote unquote controversies. And at the same time, he has supported tax policies that worsen inequality, he himself paying $750 in federal income, $750 in federal income taxes the year that he won presidency. And all of these things, when you think about it, he claims to be the candidate for the working man, but none of the things that he has done suggests that he is. And now, on the other side of the coin, in the Democratic kind of ticket, we have President-elect Joe Biden, who he is not the most progressive individual in the world, but we can definitely motivate him to support progressive policies like the Green New Deal, which really addresses the root of a lot of the structural issues in our economy. The Green New Deal seeks to transform our economy into a sustainable one, generating jobs, while at the same time promoting a lot of environmentally friendly practices. And we can also motivate him to support bills like Medicare for All, which would allow every American to receive health care regardless of their background. And this is especially necessary because we're living through a pandemic. And what really got me to the polls, to get back, I guess, to your very first question, was not the fact that Joe Biden directly represented these policies, but he was a vote in the direction of these policies and the hope that our country can be radically different than it currently is, the hope that it can actually represent our most vulnerable communities. That is what drove me to the polls. And I think that's what drove a lot of my colleagues to the polls as well.
What about the down ticket on your ballot? Were there any important, or how important were the candidates on those lines to your decision to vote?
What do you mean by a down ticket? Are you referring to the other candidates in like local?
Yes, congressional candidates, local candidates for various, state senate, state assembly, that sort of thing.
Right. I live in Nassau County, and I think that Nassau County is not the hub for progressive policies. So it wasn't that anyone in running in my local district that really kind of motivated me to go out and vote. But I think that I can speak to a sort of trend that's occurring in the country, that a lot of progressive individuals are running for House seats and Senate seats. And, AOC had this statistic that she revealed in which she said that every progressive candidate that ran on a Medicare for All ticket, they won the seat. And most of these candidates support the Green New Deal as well. So I think that there is kind of an insurgence of progressive policies that is radically inspiring people, and it's kind of getting them to go out there and vote, which is really exciting.
As you were talking with other people in your generation about the issues of the day, how much debating did you find yourself doing with those who were perhaps on the other side of the aisle, maybe as adamant about their positions as you are about yours?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely debate. It has to occur. But at the end of the day, if we are talking about specific policies, we can use historical trends. So, for example, I have referred to the Green New Deal so many times in this conversation. The Green New Deal is modeled off of FDR's New Deal plan. We can analyze how was it implemented, how was it financed, what was the positive effects of this bill, and what were the negative effects of these bills. We can use historical trends to analyze how currently proposed policies can impact the population or the economy. So when you're kind of dealing in these conversations with individuals who may disagree with you based on partisan lines, you can use data and statistics and history to tell them that, this is the projected impact, and we can kind of see that this is what will be the case because this is what has happened before.
How would you suggest that the country get back together, healing the divide, essentially?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the million-dollar question, right? But I think that's something that the Democratic Party, at the very least, needs to do, and I can speak on this, is that it needs to prioritize the economy in its conversations with kind of the media and everyday Americans. I know that I saw a CNN poll a couple of days ago when I was kind of watching CNN all night waiting for election results that said that most of the voters who prioritize the economy as their main issue ended up voting for Trump. It was, I think, 82%, though the number might be a little off, but it's around 82% of voters who prioritize the economy as their number one issue in this election voted for Trump. So, that says that the Democratic Party is doing something wrong. And in order to really unify this country, we need to realize the ways in which people feel economically disempowered, and we need to put forth solutions to their everyday problems. I mean, we can't just think we I guess what I'm trying to say is we really need to talk to people everywhere, and we need to figure out what is it at the end of the day that is making them vote in whichever direction, and we need to think how can our policies benefit them, and how can we convince them that our policies benefit them.
Ms. Dodari, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Yeah, of course.
Jenny Dodari is a student at SUNY Stony Brook, also an advocate for the New York City Fair Trade Coalition and a member of the youngest voting generation. Some members of the youngest vote-eligible generation aren't just filling out ballots, they're also running for local office. Skylar Johnson is one of them. He's 20 years old, from Mount Sinai on Long Island, and he was also a Democratic candidate for the 1st State Senate District seat. He's also a member of the Brookhaven Democratic Committee in Suffolk County. Mr. Johnson joins us on the phone. Hello, and welcome back to The Full Story.
Hi, how are you doing? Thank you for having me on.
Fine. Thanks very much. You are seeking to replace longtime incumbent Republican Ken LaValle, who is retiring. Why did you decide to run?
So there was a number of reasons why I decided to run for office, but it boils down to a couple key points. I felt that New York wasn't being represented on a number of social issues, as well as just overall. But the reason I bring up social issues is because I felt that we really didn't have any champions for things like women's rights, for things like LGBT rights. We have some advocates across the state, but I felt that in my district, we had not ever seen an advocate for important social issues. It also came down to the fact that I realized we only had representatives coming from one or two groups of people, and we really didn't have anyone from the younger generation stepping up to run. So I wanted to change that.
I understand that two of the issues that you were interested in addition to the social issues you were talking about, and you focused on these in your campaign, the cost of housing on Long Island and the cost of incarceration in New York State. Why were these issues important to you?
So to break down each of those issues, so yes, there are a number of key issues that I focused on. The prison system as well as housing were two of them. I also focused on things like healthcare, education, and the environment. But when I first started the campaign, those were two issues that I brought up, especially at the beginning. The housing crisis on Long Island is unmanageable right now. We're seeing people whose family have lived here for generations being forced off the island because they simply cannot afford the high cost of living here anymore. And as someone who is a college student, as someone who's only 20 years old, I have a lot of friends who are leaving the island as soon as they graduate school because they cannot potentially find housing here. There is no way that they are going to find housing that they can afford while working a job straight out of college. I had a friend who was attending classes and falling asleep because he was working 60-hour weeks to afford the cost of tuition and the cost of his housing while attending school, and it was unacceptable. He basically had no life because he was going from work to school back to work. He wasn't sleeping. It meant he was underperforming in his classes. It meant he wasn't getting his work done. So I really wanted to tackle the housing crisis on the island in my policy. When it comes to incarceration, a lot of times the criminal justice system, we kind of neglect policy around that. A lot of times people feel very uncomfortable discussing it, so it just never gets discussed, and I find that that's unacceptable. The reason that I brought up the cost of incarceration is because New York has one of the highest costs of incarceration of any prison system in the United States. What I brought up to people is, look, if we can change the criminal justice system in a way that lowers the rate of incarceration, besides the undoubtable social good that we'll do, it will save the state a lot of money. But what I really wanted to do was not just save the state money. I really wanted to help people. We have a recidivism rate of over 70% of the United States. Over 70% of people who leave prison will return within 5 years. And we really need to change the system because we have a school-to-prison pipeline in New York and across the country. And I really wanted to start writing policy to combat that.
Just a side note question here. How long have you been interested in politics? How long have you been paying attention to issues like this?
I've kind of always been interested in politics. Something I would always say on the campaign, I would always bring up the fact that when I was 11 years old, I was already arguing for pro-choice rights. I have a memory of being in an art class in sixth grade, and I got into an argument with a young woman in my class that about the right to choose. So this has been something that I've always cared about, and as I've gotten older, I've just gotten more deeply passionate about these issues.
You mentioned how the cost of housing is clearly an issue to people in your generation. The issue of incarceration costs. How did people your age react to your campaigning on that issue?
So that issue, a lot of people actually really liked that I was campaigning on that because, again, it went past the cost of incarceration and really went to the broader lack of social justice. I originally pitched the idea as, you know, incarceration cost way too much. We got to change that. But really, I was just trying to form the basis for this policy platform that I expanded on. So I would speak to people about the criminal justice system, and a lot of people really, really reacted to that, especially after the death of George Floyd, when we saw the surge of Black Lives Matter protests. because the criminal justice system is part of the systemic injustice that we've seen in the United States for centuries. So a lot of people who are young were really, really happy to see a candidate running on criminal justice reform because it is desperately needed. And unfortunately, a lot of times candidates shy away from it because they're afraid of offending someone, or they're afraid of the counter messaging of, oh, they want to let criminals into the streets, which is a scare tactic. So a lot of young people really were happy to see me, were really happy to see me run on a criminal justice platform.
You've answered at least in part my next question, which is, how did your peers respond to your campaign?
So my peers were thrilled. People my age were really, really thrilled to see a young person running. I actually pretty much raised the first $1,000 that I actually fundraised on the campaign just from speaking to my friends at school. Over the course of a couple of days, I spoke to people and I started to receive donations of $5, $10, $25. I had a couple of people who said to me, listen, I'm not working right now. I really can't afford to donate, but I'm still going to donate $3. There was a couple of times where I told people, look, if you cannot afford to donate, please do not donate. I'm running to help people, not to take your money. But overall, young people were just really, really happy to see me running. It was amazing because it wasn't just people that I knew personally. As time went on, I saw it across the country. I had 18-year-olds reaching out to me from states like California or Alaska or Texas saying, hey, listen, I just want to let you know that I saw you running and you've inspired me to run for office myself, or you've inspired me to get more involved, or I'm now going to volunteer on a local campaign, or I'm going to volunteer on your campaign. So we had young people from across the nation who wanted to donate and volunteer and were just inspired by seeing a young person running.
You mentioned back a number of years ago when you were in grade school debating with a young classmate on a particular issue. During the campaign, did you interact with people your age, with your peers, who simply didn't agree with you? And did you have a chance to try to convince them? Did they try to convince you to change your mind?
Absolutely. So I had a mixture of views when I spoke to people in the campaign. Most young people that I spoke to were very receptive because, quite frankly, young people know that the system isn't working and they want it to change. The system has never worked for people in my generation, so they want things to change. I did have someone, a former classmate of mine, actually message me on Instagram and ask me more about my views. And he's a registered Republican. He was supporting Donald Trump in the presidential election. He almost never votes for Democrats, but he messaged me and said, hey, look, you're running for office. I just want to know more about your views. And we messaged back and forth for a little bit, and he took what I had to say into consideration. I had people who didn't fully agree with my views, but they liked the basis of what I was saying. Overall, most people in my age group did support my values because a lot of young people in my age group have very similar values. So it's a myth. You're always going to see it on the campaign. But overall, I had a net positive feedback from my generation. And when I spoke to people who didn't agree with me, I was more than happy to discuss with them to figure out where we could find middle ground, or at least where we were having a disagreement.
Do you feel that there are political divisions on Long Island that young people can help heal?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of hate over here. We unfortunately have seen that in the last couple of weeks as tension heated up surrounding the presidential race. We had a number of incidents right out by me where we had a large group of Trump supporters going by, and at points they were screaming homophobic slurs. There's been a lot of hate in our area, and what I would like to see is people trying to come together. That's something that's easier said than done, though. Mm. What we really need to focus on is accomplishing things for the general public, is getting things done. Because if we just talk about unity but don't put forward any actual policy, we're not going to get anything done. So yes, I would like to see unity, but my main focus is making sure that we're accomplishing things for the people who have been overlooked all these years.
Your challenger in the primary, Laura Ahern, the executive director of the nonprofit Parents for Megan's Law and the Crime Victim Center, she won the Democratic nomination to run against New York State Assemblyman Anthony Palumbo, the Republican from New Suffolk. What do you attribute to her victory in the primary?
Yeah, absolutely. I do have to say it quite frankly, it came down to money in the end. My campaign didn't really pick up fundraising until the end of the campaign because we had some pushback at the beginning because people weren't sure about the 19-year-old progressive running for the state senate. They weren't sure how that was going to work. It was once we had actually proven that I was a viable candidate that we really started to see money raised. We raised, I believe, $15,000 between mid-May and towards the end mid-June. We started to raise money fairly quickly. However, however, Laura Ahern did have a lot of money to begin with. She was able to fundraise from a lot of very, very wealthy people, and there was a lot of outside spending in that race. So when it came down to a year where we had a ton of new voters from who are voting absentee, we had a lot of people who really hadn't heard of anyone but Laura Ahern by the time they voted because they had seen her advertising. We were able to utilize social media and other creative forms of messaging. However, we weren't able to reach the amount of people that we needed to before the primary.
I should mention here, too, as we speak today, the absentee ballots have not all been counted yet in that race. But right now, Anthony Palumbo is ahead. Again, the absentee ballots have not yet been counted on in that race. I want to ask you, too, what would you say is the main lesson that you learned in this campaign?
So, honestly, for me, while running, it really came down to policy again. I got to speak to thousands of people across the district, and I was able to hear voices on issues that I didn't really know much about. I always prided myself as the policy candidate, as the research candidate. But as I spoke to people, there were new issues. There were new issues that presented themselves that I had the chance to learn about. But also, it really kind of proved to me that a young person can do well running for office. Because while we had some people at the beginning say, well, you know, can a 19-year-old really win? It's because they hadn't seen it before. They had not seen someone my age running for office. So once they saw that I was serious, they were really willing to jump on board and to support my campaign. So that was a lesson that I learned, that young people really can run for office and can really succeed in running for office. And I hope that lesson stuck with people who are following my campaign, because I want to see more of them stepping up to run for office, whether it be state senate or eventually Congress or their school board, or even joining their local civics and becoming involved in that measure of democracy. So I really hope that that lesson stuck with people who are following my campaign.
I think I know the answer to this. Will you run again?
As long as I feel that I can properly represent the people in the district in question, I would run for office again, yes.
What's your advice for young people who want to get involved in politics, maybe haven't stepped into it just yet?
So if you want to get involved in politics but haven't stepped in yet, I would seriously suggest volunteering on a local campaign. I was the campaign manager for a local race before I ran for office. I volunteered in other campaigns before that. I would suggest volunteering. Even if you're not like physically going into an office or knocking on people's doors, if you can make phone calls or send text messages or write postcards, that's a stepping stone, because you might get to interact with the candidate and you get to interact with other volunteers who are really, really passionate. So you might learn a little bit about that campaign and about the issues facing your district and your area. I would also suggest, again, as I said before, joining your local civic organization, because the civics are the base level, are basically the base level of government. And they involve the issues on the most local level possible, because they only involve your town. So I would suggest joining your civic, and I would suggest volunteering on the campaign, because you might be able to learn a lot about your area before you step into a higher role in politics.
Mr. Johnson, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Skylar Johnson is a 20-year-old member of the Brookhaven Democratic Committee in Suffolk County. I'm Tom Kuser, and this is The Full Story. Today we're focusing on the growing engagement of younger voters in politics. And we're joined now via Skype by two politically involved college students. They both attend Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. They're both political science majors and both from Connecticut. Colby Driscoll is 21. She's a senior, and she'll be graduating in May of 2021, and she is the president of the College Democrats Club. Mateo Menta is a 20-year-old junior. He's also pursuing minors in business economics, and he is president of the College Republicans Club. And welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Certainly. I'd like to start by asking you both how long you've been involved in politics. Colby?
Yeah, definitely. So I got my start in politics at a very young age. I grew up watching my grandfather really involved in our local town politics, and watched him run for a bunch of different offices and was really a leader in our town, was very inspirational to me. So really from a young age, I had a great interest in it. And when I got to college, I wanted to pursue that, and I wanted to make it a career and kind of, you know, continue continue what he started and what really inspired me in life. And, you know, it's been a deep passion of mine. And ever since then, I've always sought out different positions on, you know, elections, tried to work in different areas of politics. And it really is something that I love to do. I love helping others and I love, you know, being that voice to represent others as well.
And Mateo, how about you?
Yeah, so I've always had an interest in politics, but I really started getting involved in the campaign process freshman year here. I volunteered on some local campaigns, which were a great load of fun, and they gave me contacts. And every semester I've been at Sacred Heart, I've actually helped out on a different campaign. Most recently, I was the field coordinator for State Senator Tony Wong's campaign. And honestly, this has just been an amazing experience. Being involved in local government can give you such an education, honestly. And I'm so thankful for that experience.
And can you tell me a little bit more, elaborate on that a little bit more, Mateo? What specifically piqued your interest when it comes to participating in this kind of deep interest in the political process?
I think my real interest comes from the fact that I believe the concept of America is something really, really special and unique. No other country in the world is like us. And I think when you realize just how unique and innovative we are as a country, what kind of values we stand for, you want to be a contributing factor to that legacy, to be someone to carry the torch, so to speak, in your generation. I think that's why a lot of people, especially my age, are interested in politics. And that's certainly something that has made me want to get up every day and contribute to the country that I love.
And Colby, you mentioned seeing your grandfather deeply involved. What was it that made you want to follow that path?
Definitely. I saw the impact that he was able to have on our town and in our community. He really, you know, was a voice for a lot of people in our town and represented what they needed and what they wanted and was, you know, a great resource for them. And I was just inspired by the amount of people that felt comfortable going to him for advice or with their issues. And, you know, he was actually able to make great change in our town and in our community. And that's what really, you know, inspired me. I looked up to him so much growing up and, you know, he's since passed, but I really do try to, you know, continue on his legacy and make him proud.
A silly question. Did you both vote?
Yes.
Yes, I definitely voted.
I'm wondering, too, did you, obviously, you're both very enthusiastic. Did you sense enthusiasm among your peers to also go out and vote in this election?
Yeah, definitely. I think this election season was a very, you know, popular one. There was a lot of attention on obviously the presidential race between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. That really got a lot of people's attention, especially our younger generations and people our age. So I really do think that there was a lot of, you know, engagement and a lot of, you know, inspiration to get out and vote. I know I encouraged all of my friend group to vote, and, you know, they did. They either stood in line on Tuesday the 3rd or they sent in their absentee ballot. But definitely, I think there was a lot of engagement and a lot of participation this time around.
And how about your perspective, Mateo?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first chance a lot of people had to actually vote in a, number one, in a presidential election. So for me, I was able to vote in 2018, but this is my first time voting for a president. And I think that excites people because presidential elections have the scale, they have the drama, they have the intensity. So a lot of people were really interested this time around. In my personal friend group, I helped a few of them get registered to vote even. And I think I saw a great amount of enthusiasm and passion in my own club as well.
Mateo, what do younger people bring to the table that's missing when they don't participate?
What I don't think young people realize is there's a culture that your vote doesn't count. And young people typically need a little more prodding to vote. That's just based on statistics. So when you're giving them that culture and that laziness in regard, not in regard to young people are lazy, but they are not likely to vote. But I think what young people need to realize is they are voting on the America that they are going to inherit from their parents. Right now, these issues seem far off. They seem a little distant from them. But in 20 years, these are going to be especially relevant to the lives they live as adults outside of college, outside of high school. So really, they're voting on their future, what kind of America they want to live in when they get older. Elections are more relevant to young people than anybody else because they're the ones who are going to be inheriting these decisions in the long term.
And Colby, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with a lot of what Mateo was saying is in terms of, you know, our voice really matters and you know, the way that we vote is going to be so influential in our future lives. And, you know, when I always encourage, you know, young people to vote, and especially students in college, because even though, you know, they might not feel so inclined to vote in that exact moment, I try to help them understand and see that, you know, their vote is going to have a lasting effect for 2 to 4 years, depending on, you know, which election we're voting on, especially for president. You know, the presidential elections are every 4 years, and we get that opportunity every 4 years, which is kind of like a large time gap when you think about it. So definitely it's very, you know, consequential for voting. And I definitely encourage all, you know, young voters in college, and definitely my club, because a lot of what's happening in our legislation directly affects us as young people.
Where do you think that attitude comes from? Mateo, you mentioned some people you talk to say, well, my vote doesn't matter. Where does that come from? Where does that attitude originate? Who tells them that?
I think it's more of a cultural problem than just targeted towards young people. It's one that's passed down. America has dramatically lower voter participation rates than anywhere else in the world, at least in the Western world. We are, I think, down 20%. Some countries have as high as 80% voter participation. We are usually around 60. So I think because of the culture of, we have this idea of swing states, and we have the idea of, well, Connecticut's already a lock on Democrat anyway, people don't see the value in voting. They're too focused, and this might be the heart of the problem. We put too much spotlight on the national elections, when they don't consider the fact that your vote matters incredibly much at the lower level, but that's not really talked about. So even though the immediate day-to-day decisions of your lives are controlled by state politics, people don't vote because they don't realize that those decisions actually really matter, especially in Connecticut, which only a few years ago had, even though it's a very blue state nationally, had a tied House of Representatives, Republicans, Democrats.
Colby, you mentioned a couple of times about how much influence and how much your grandfather was able to do locally. Do you feel the same way about that? The local vote is as important as the national vote, even when we're talking about a time when there are so many huge issues nationally and internationally that need to be dealt with.
Yeah, I definitely agree that, you know, everyone's vote matters on a local and state level as well. I had just finished an internship with the state capitol working for a representative. So I was hands-on in our state capitol in Hartford, you know, learning about the legislative process and getting involved and meeting new people there. And I was really able to see how much our state legislature is able to accomplish, and everything that they are able to, you know, do pretty much in their capacity. And a lot of what is happening up in Hartford, and a lot of what is happening in our local town halls and everything, really do affect us, like Mateo said, on a daily basis. And while national and international business and issues are also very important, I think a lot of people really neglect the fact that it's equally as important to vote in your state and local elections as well.
I'm talking with Colby Driscoll, the president of the College Democrats Club at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut, and with Mateo Menta. He's the president of the College Republicans Club at Sacred Heart. I'd like to ask you both, do you find it at all difficult as young people to attract serious attention to your ideas from the leaders in your respective parties? Mateo?
I think that's always a challenge of younger generations, is to be taken seriously, so to speak. We obviously have a lot of ideas. We have a lot of issues we care deeply about. And I think as both parties are evolving over time, that voice is going to become much more important. It is, I would say, disappointing, I think, the fact that younger voters aren't cared about as much, and I think in either party, to be honest. And that needs to be a voice that's heard more.
Colby, what about from your perspective?
So I definitely think that, you know, in the past, the younger voice and the younger vote has been a little neglected. But I do believe that over time, and, you know, right now, and as we progress further, I really do think that, you know, individuals that are in office and also individuals running for office are going to take us a little bit more seriously, because we did see a highly high turnout of young voters during this election. And I feel like a lot of us, especially college students, are really starting to voice up. They're getting involved. You know, the College Democrats Club here at SHU is pretty robust. We have a lot of people that are very politically minded, very interested in getting involved in politics. And we have a lot of participation in different, you know, elections and with different representatives throughout the state. And I'm sure Mateo can speak to that as well, because I know that his club is equally as successful as ours. So I really do think that we are moving in the right direction in terms of, you know, being taken seriously on a political stage, because people are realizing that we have a large voice. There's a large number of young people and college kids that are interested in politics. So, you know, a little while ago in the past, we might not have been taken as seriously as we should have, but I think we are definitely progressing in the right direction.
As you mentioned, this was certainly a large voter turnout of younger voters for this election. And you're saying that you think that's gotten the attention of the two major political parties, Republicans and Democrats. Do you think this is sustainable, or how would you sustain this kind of interest in future elections?
So definitely to sustain it, I would say to keep up the energy and keep up the effort that has already, you know, been established. I think that a lot of young people are now a little bit more motivated to vote because they might be understanding more of how their vote is, you know, impactful. And it really goes back to education. As long as we really educate voters on the importance of voting, but then also tie it in and kind of work with our representatives and work with those who are running for office and kind of help them understand that every vote matters and that, you know, they need to be aware and, you know, willing to work with a wide variety of demographic of voters, especially the young vote.
Mateo, do you think it'll be difficult to keep up this enthusiasm, this level of participation in future elections?
Yeah. During presidential election years, you're naturally going to have a boost to this kind of involvement. So the fact that we actually had more young voter turnout than 2016 is promising, but it shouldn't be taken for granted. And I think this comes down to what the party leadership actually does. And this is because of two factors. The first being, if this is a growing amount of people who are showing up to the polls, parties need to start advertising to those voters. They need to start highlighting their needs. And then I think this is just a general point. Parties need to show why the issues are actually relevant to people. When you throw terms like illegal immigration or climate change or coronavirus at people, they're going to get overwhelmed. You need to communicate why it's important, not just the issue. If you talk about just facts and figures and numbers, people don't see how it affects them, and you engage voters by showing why elections are relevant to them.
What do you want those who have been engaged in the political system for a long time to know about you as, to some extent, newcomers to the process? I know you've been involved for a number of years, but you know what I mean.
Do you mean to young voters in general or to me and Colby specifically?
Well, tell me about you and Colby, about you specifically, Mateo, and Colby, the same question to you. And if you've got a thought about what you think, generally speaking, the establishment needs to know about young voters, I'd be interested in hearing that, too.
I think as me and Colby, what I like about our relationship specifically is that even though we are very partisan people, very engaged people, we have a relationship that's very operable. Me and Colby have spoken probably around 25 times a semester about politics, and we're still able to engage with people. And I think that's the lesson people can take away about young voters as well, just looking at how we can operate. More and more young people are flocking to the independent party, just being unaffiliated voters. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason behind that. And that is, they don't like party politics. They do not like the anger. And in the coming years, we need to start reducing the partisan tensions. And that comes with being willing to forgive other people for having different beliefs than you and acknowledging that their beliefs aren't going to change. So I look at myself, I look at Colby, I look at other young leaders I've seen, and the unifying factor among what makes them capable is they're willing to be tolerant.
Colby.
Yeah, so I definitely agree with Mateo and, you know, to the fact that we are, although we're the presidents of the two respective parties, we are really able to, you know, work collaboratively and get along. And really, we try to bring our clubs together in a way that facilitates, you know, great conversation. And we do debates every so often. We're able to do that, and we're able to connect with each other to kind of show ourselves and our generation that, you know, the two parties can get along. It really is possible to work together and reach across the aisle and have that collaborative teamwork that we might not necessarily see on, you know, the national and federal levels. It really is possible. And I would love the, you know, the leaders and the current members of the two respective parties to kind of watch what we're doing and see that younger people are able to work together, and maybe it can inspire, you know, current members of the party to work together. And also, I like speaking for, you know, myself and, you know, a vast number of young voters, just to generally be taken seriously by, you know, the members, the older members of the two political parties. Because I think we talked about this before, you know, not being taken seriously in politics and stuff like that. I definitely think that is a bridge that needs to be, you know, crossed. So I think that is definitely an important factor.
Well, it's certainly been refreshing to talk with both of you today. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much for having us. It was a great time as well.
Thank you very much.
I've been talking with Colby Driscoll, the president of the College Democrats Club at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut, and with Mateo Menta, the president of the College Republicans Club at Sacred Heart. Did you vote? Tell us why or why not. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. And that's it for our program today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.